From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, we take on the news of 2016 and what a year it was. The polls did not predict it, but Donald Trump took the U.S. presidency. An earthquake for Republicans and Democrats. Here was election night.
I've just received a call from Secretary Clinton. She congratulated us, it's about us, on our victory. And I congratulated her and her family on a very, very hard-fought campaign.
That it was. The EU lost the UK. Another shocker. Here was the final count.
The total number of votes cast in favor of leave was 17,410,742. This means that the UK has voted to leave the European Union.
Yeah! And woe out of Aleppo as the bombs rained down. Activist Lina Alshami went to Twitter to say goodbye.
To everyone who can hear me, we are here exposed to a genocide in the besieged city of Aleppo. This may be my last video.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable takes on the year 2016 with David Sanger, Karen Tumulty, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. From presidential politics to Brexit to Russia, China, police shootings and protests, what has this year brought? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Tumult is right there in your name, Karen. That's good for this year. It's great to have you here.
It's been my year.
Karen Tumulty, no less. Happy New Year. Great to have you here. Also from Washington, pardon me, David Sanger joins us, national security correspondent for The New York Times. He's been hard at work on big stories this week. John Kerry on Israel, Washington sanctioning Moscow, and election hacking. David, wonderful to have you with us. Happy New Year to you, New Year to you as well.
Happy New Year to you and to Karen and to Jack. Yeah, it's been the year ended as it proceeded through the entire year, which was, you know, three stories a day, right?
Yes, an absolute tumult of stories. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty is right here with us. Jack, welcome. Great to have you here.
Hello, Tom, and Happy New Year to you, David, and Karen.
And forgive me, I'm sick as a dog, but we're going to do this. I got a chest cold that will not quit. We're going to look at the entire year, but I want to dive right in on this week because we've had major headlines this week. And David, you've been on them just in the last day. We have the U.S. retaliating against Russia, Washington against Moscow for hacking during the election season in this country. What's the breadth and weight of the sanctions? Is that the right word for them that Washington's put on Moscow, David?
Well, compared to the sanctions that the Obama administration did after the Russian annexation of Crimea and the invasions of eastern Ukraine, these don't count for a whole lot. These are throwing out 35 diplomats who are probably not diplomats and some sanctions.
That is, there may be spies.
They're probably spies. Mm-hmm. And some economic and travel sanctions on members of the GRU, the Russian intelligence service, who are not likely to be taking the kids to Disneyland on their vacation in any case.
Yeah. Okay.
But that said, this was a marker that President Obama felt he had to put down, and one that many believe he put down far too late in response to the astounding Russian involvement in the election. And the question is, has he created enough of a deterrent here, not only for Russia as elections proceed in Germany and in France, but also for other countries that might say, gee, you can use a little bit of hacking and a little bit of information warfare, and more people will read the fake news than will read Sanger and Tumulty. Astounding, as that is to imagine.
Hello. we had the foreign minister from Russia, Lavrov, came right out saying, you know, this is lousy. He said there would be Russian sanctions. Putin later took that back, but here's the foreign minister, Sergey Lavrov. Okay, after the Obama news, he said this departing administration accusing Russia of all mortal sins, trying also to accuse us in failure of their foreign policy initiatives, has put forward groundless accusations against us that Russia on a state level has interfered with U.S. election campaigning in which a Democratic candidate had been defeated. Karen Tumulty, David Sanger wanted to see something done earlier, but how much earlier could Obama have done something? It's only weeks ago now that the CIA came out and said publicly, yes, there was interference, and it was in favor of one candidate, Donald Trump.
Said publicly, but as the New York Times, including David, have documented, I mean, all of this was clear earlier. But the fact is that this has now been going on for years. This is a new form of warfare. I mean, we saw it not just in this interference with our election, but 2 years ago with the Sony hacks. This is a new kind of engagement, and it does feel like, you know, possibly when historians look back at this period, they are going to see something really important happening here.
I mean, Jack, talk about a headline from this week that lights up so much of the year when you look back at how those WikiLeaks things dropped. And, of course, the assertion here is that those were fed by Russian hackers. I mean, we have an American election that the CIA, anyway, says was interfered with and maybe pushed toward Donald Trump. I mean, if you can just come in every 4 years and put a finger on the scales of American democracy, and with that potentially determine the outcome, I mean, American policy will change and dramatically over these next years. If Moscow has had a role in that, what a handy way to manipulate the world.
Yes, and it isn't as if we can retaliate on similar grounds. I mean, their elections are rigged to begin with. And we have the extraordinary circumstance of the president-elect, who was the beneficiary of this intervention, denying that it happened and essentially defying his own intelligence services, the people he's going to have to work with.
Though
he
says he'll talk with them next week, right?
I mean, he will deign to talk with them next week. Hear from them, and perhaps that will change his mind. But he sees this, even the talking about it, as trying to delegitimize his election, rather than, in fact, what it was. It appears to be an unprecedented intervention in our election by a really not a friendly power at all.
Here was Donald Trump. He was at Mar-a-Lago yesterday, a kind of impromptu press engagement there on the steps of Mar-a-Lago, saying, let's move on. Let's get on with our lives.
I think we ought to get on with our lives. I think that computers have complicated lives very greatly. The whole age of computer has made it where nobody knows exactly what's going on. We have speed. We have a lot of other things, but I'm not sure you have the kind of security that you need.
The whole age of computer kind of hand-waving there. David Sanger, the Obama administration has hinted, is that the right word, that there may be other cyber counterattacks? I suppose not on the Russian election front. That might not be the most vulnerable Russian target or even juicy. But do you? This is kind of your meat and potatoes. Do you have any idea whether and where the U.S. might hit in cyber terms against Russia?
Well, a few, Tom, but let's not lose the opportunity to go parse for a moment President-elect Trump's response in that clip that you played, because the question he was asked was about Russia and their interference.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer he gave was about how complicated computers have made our lives. Yeah. He actually went that entire paragraph without mentioning the word Russia.
Yeah, look over there.
So it's the question here is whether an old adversary has made use of a new tool and technology, which is hardly new in the world of international relations. And the issue is the adversary. It's not necessarily the issue of the technology, although the technology itself is fascinating. Now, on to your question. Look, what you're trying to accomplish here is deterring Russia and other foreign powers from violating norms of behavior using cyber techniques that they think will enable them to influence events or mess you up without causing and triggering a full-scale war. And they've used that very skillfully. And we use this quite skillfully as well. Think about the American-Israeli attack on the Iranian nuclear program. So we've got a new set of technologies. And President Obama, in judging whether to take a covert cyber action, has to ask himself the question, and then what? So if we do this to Putin, does he escalate? I think what we learned in Putin's decision not to throw the diplomats out.
He came out after Lavrov and said, no, they can stay. His spokesman said, we proceed from the premise that these decisions were taken by President Obama, that in 3 weeks, Donald Trump will be the new head of state. So
he did more than that, Tom. He invited the kids of the American diplomats, who he's not throwing out, to come to the Kremlin and enjoy the
New
Christmas
Year's
trees at the New Year's party, which I thought was actually a pretty good touch. Okay, this guy is good. Okay,
I mean,
he knows what he's doing.
The course of American history may have been changed, or
influenced by this hacking, Kara. I mean, this is gigantic.
Well, we don't know, actually.
Well, the May sits there large, but if we don't know, what an amazing thing to say.
It's – and again, there is also the question of if the evidence was there before the election, and a fair amount of it was, why did President Obama wait until after the election to decide to bring this out? Another question is, would they be doing the same thing had Hillary Clinton won anyway?
They might well have. I suppose, Jack, it's pretty tough. It was hard to come in on the eve of the election and say, well, this has all been set up by Moscow. Election season is fraught, and this was triple fraught with Donald Trump's style. But here we have this thing, Jack, where the charge has been made, and the incoming president says, well, but pay no mind.
Pay no mind. And, of course, if President Obama had intervened before the election, the cry would have been, this is the rigged election I've been talking about, Trump would say. But, you know, there was a moment there where the president sent his security team to the Hill. They spoke to Democrats and Republicans. Let's go out all together, bipartisan, and say, Russia, stop. Mitch McConnell said, if you do that, I will say this is partisan politics.
Yeah. And there it was. Talk about a 2016 moment. We are looking at a week in the news and a year in the news. 2016 with David Sanger, The New York Times, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, our own Jack Beatty. Purple Rain behind us here. Of course, Prince died in April at 57. You can join us this hour. Is the Obama administration right to hit Russia for its hacking of the U.S. election season? Is John Kerry right to attack, deplore Israel's settlements in the West Bank? What do you make of 2016? This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, a year in the news this hour. 2016, presidential politics, Trump, Brexit, Aleppo, China tensions, Russia tensions, a sense of events tumbling, unpredictable, and certainly not at the end of 2016 under American control. David Sanger is with us from The New York Times, joins us from Washington, as does Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us as well. What do you see as the most important developments, events of this year? Where do you see the Trump election turning the country? Where do you see, what's the meaning, the likely impact of the Trump earthquake? Where is Europe headed with Brexit, its own populism, terrorism, refugees? Why is Russia suddenly seemingly in the middle of everything? I mean, all the news of this week sort of seeps out into the news of the year, but I want to hit one more before we go bigger to the year, and that was John Kerry this year before the UN, in his big speech there, talking about Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Very, very emotional speech, a very, very tough language. Here he was saying that Israel just doesn't understand. We have to do that. This is all about Israel's future and American values.
They fail to recognize that this friend, the United States of America, that has done more to support Israel than any other country, cannot be true to our own values if we allow a viable two-state solution to be destroyed before our own eyes.
And more, friends need to tell hard truths, he said.
Friends need to tell each other the hard truths. And friendships require mutual respect.
David Sanger, how unusual was this speech? How do you imagine its impact?
Well, it was pretty unusual, and it was John Kerry saying in public what he has often said in private. And to hear that kind of language, you had to sort of listen to him on trips or over dinners and so forth. And so the oddity was that he stripped out all of the usual diplomatic niceties and laid out what has been the American position. But, you know, just to link it to our previous conversation, if the question about Barack Obama's sanctions on Russia were they 6 months too late, the question about Kerry's speech is, was it 2.5 years too late? And he gave this speech when he had 3 weeks left in office, no time to negotiate anything, instead of giving it when the negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians failed to get off the ground in 2014. He moved on to the Iran negotiation, which he was successful at. Then he moved on to the Syria ceasefire, yep, which he was not successful at. But the big question here was, if he really believed that Israel was heading off a cliff, that the prime minister was captive to a right-wing group that is does not have the country's long-term interests at heart by continuing the settlements and undermining a chance for a two-state solution, the big question is, could he have gotten more done giving that speech in 2014?
Karen Tumulty, does John Kerry have backing in Congress? I mean, Donald Trump is saying six ways to Sunday. You know, what he tweeted, stay strong, Israel. January 20th is fast approaching, i.e. his inauguration. He'll turn it all around. Is John Kerry whistling in the wind here as he leaves?
Well, he actually got a fair amount of criticism from his own party, including Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, the incoming minority leader, Senator Ben Cardin. It was a lot of frustration speaking in that speech, but I think it was also very much of a swan song for this administration's policy and probably for possibly at least for the two-state solution. Donald Trump has already announced that he is going to name a U.S. ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, mm-hmm, who is a very staunch supporter of the settlements.
He's personally helped fund some of them.
And he is – so he has signaled is – you know, in he hasn't signaled a lot of things very clearly in foreign policy, but he has this. I mean, he intends to take U.S. policy in an entirely different direction.
Jack, here's another one of these issues that at the end of 2016 feels like is this the change of an era? Will this be – will the – you know, 4 years from now, we'll have to think back hard to remember when a two-state solution had been American policy for decades and this, the sands blow over it and it's gone. But where does that point Israel? Where does that point the Middle East, Jack?
Well, if people like Tom Friedman are right, it points Israel to a moment of reckoning. Between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, there's the populations are pretty much equal now, Jewish and Israeli and Arab. And at a certain point, there's going to be a moment of choice, or it won't be a moment. It'll evolve.
Kerry said you can't be a Jewish state and a democratic state without a two-state solution.
That's right. Will there be a kind of is the South Africa model what this puts us on the road to?
In perpetuity.
In perpetuity. And you know, the American goading and the American pressure was important for Israel and for people in Israel who wanted a settlement. To take that away now, to take that kind of pressure away, is to empower, I think, these more right-wing elements that Kerry deployed. You know, one element of this, Charles Krauthammer today says, President Obama has an animus against Israel. An animus? $38 billion arms deal.
Biggest ever.
And I read in the Israeli press today, he is the only president since Lyndon Johnson not to have allowed the Security Council resolution critical of Israel to pass. President Reagan, 21 different times, either allowed things to pass or voted against Israel. Obama has protected Israel for 8 years, the only president since Lyndon Johnson to do it, and he's criticized as being an enemy of Israel.
Watch this space. Karen, another, I have to ask you on the congressional support front, Obama and Moscow, is there support for the retaliation that he is taking right now, expelling Russian diplomats, going after the Russian intelligence agencies? How's that being taken on board on the Hill? And if Donald Trump comes in on January 20th and turns it all around, is there support for that? What do Republicans have to say, let alone Democrats, about Trump's very cozy apparent attitude toward Putin?
Actually, President Obama has gotten a lot of support from Republicans for this. The main criticism being that whether it was too little, too late. So I think that he has, as David wrote, he may have boxed Donald Trump in on this. It's going to be hard for him to pull back these sanctions.
But here we've got Putin saying, well, I'm not going to expel your people, essentially, because Don's coming and he'll take care of me.
That's the brilliance of the Putin move, because it sort of throws Trump this lifeline and says, I'm forgetting about Obama. We can start afresh. Yeah. He's sort of pretending this entire little unhappy incident never occurred.
Wow. Morgan in Austin, Texas. Morgan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Jack and Karen and David. I hope you get better soon, Tom.
Thank you. Me too.
My concern, this is regarding the alleged Russian hacks. My concern has been primarily this. Whenever I tune into major syndicated media outlets, either on the radio or on the television, more and more what I see is a discussion about what these hacks mean, how we should respond, why Putin is trying to do this. What I don't see are a lot of journalists covering the contents of the leaks and taking an opportunity that I see, and I think a lot of other people see, to talk about some of the intrinsic problems in our democratic system and some of the unhappiness that's present among the general populace, sort of missing an opportunity to do a true post-mortem.
Morgan, let me ask you about that, though, because I do have to say, Morgan, over the summer, when these leaks came out, there was wall-to-wall coverage of these leaks from the Democratic National Committee, just nonstop for a very long time. It's not as though they were ignored at all. I mean, that's why they came to play some major sway in the vote, right?
Ignored. And it's true there was wall-to-wall coverage, but the wall-to-wall coverage took on the characteristics of a lot of the coverage now. I know Hillary Clinton was the first to speak a lot about it when it occurred in the summer, and again, a lot of the focus on major news stations was not about the contents of the leaks, but rather about the intention of the leakers.
I have to straight up disagree with that characterization. I just don't think that's how it was over the summer. But let me ask you this, Morgan, and I take your point. I mean, there were some unsettling things in there. I don't know if they deserve to throw an entire election, but they were certainly unsettling. Sure. But what about the interference, if that's what it is, the CIA says so, of a major outside other country in American elections? If this is how the future rolls, and you know, we get rolled every 4 years, is
I guess one of my concerns is sort of summed up with, like, to hear a journalist say, because the CIA said so. The CIA is a branch of the executive government, and it's never journalistically been really held as ironclad.
I mean, help me out here, Morgan. I'm not pinning it all on the CIA, but all 17 intelligence agencies have said it. It could still be wrong, but does it not give you pause?
Of course it gives me pause. Of course it gives me pause. But what also gives me pause is the reluctance of the sort of media establishment to have an open and honest conversation about some of the reasons that this man Trump has been elected. I think in a lot of ways this is a distraction from some of the really important questions we need to be asking ourselves.
Morgan, I appreciate your call. I got it. I mean, I have to say, we've been talking nonstop about President-elect Trump's election since it happened and before, and looking with all the openness and honesty we can muster at the reasons for it. That will go on. But Karen, do you think that there is something out of whack in the way the American media has responded to first the leaks and then the assertion of foreign interference?
Well, it was interesting because a lot of the criticism that we were hearing was of the media for covering the contents, because the argument being that this was stolen material. Of course, you could say the same about the Pentagon Papers as well.
Yeah.
There was newsworthy content in it. It was covered. Debbie Wasserman Schultz lost the chairmanship of the DNC over it.
Yep.
So I think that in this case, it took us all into places where we'd never been before. But I do think that the contents were newsworthy and they were covered.
Let's go right to Morgan's bigger thirst there for a conversation about Donald Trump and why he won in 2016. Karen, you've covered this front to back, top to bottom. Here we sit on almost the last day of the year. Give us your interpretation of what happened in this country politically with the election that resulted in the election of Donald Trump. What did we see there?
Well, what happened basically is that more people voted for him in the states that he needed to win than voted for Hillary Clinton. We have sliced and diced this electorate now so many times. There's been so much talk about white working class voters, the socioeconomic differences in voters. There's also been a lot of analysis of who didn't show up. And I think there's as good of an argument to make that who didn't show up through this election as much as who did. She underperformed among young people, among African Americans. She just, you know, wasn't able to sort of pull this thing together and get it over the line. So we can talk about the Comey leaks. We can talk about a whole bunch of individual factors, any one of which could have done it. But the fact is, ultimately, she, you know, we had the most disliked candidate in American history running against the second most disliked candidate in American history. And, you know, she just wasn't able to pull it together.
Got the popular vote, didn't get the White House. This was Trump at the Republican National Convention in July, saying he was the voice of those who were affected by unfair trade deals, laid off factory workers.
These are the forgotten men and women of our country, and they are forgotten, but they're not going to be forgotten long. These are people who work hard, but no longer have a voice. I am your voice.
January 20th, he will be president. David Sanger, what's your bottom line? Almost the end of the year, interpretation of what happened in this country this year politically that brings us President Trump.
Well, I think the first thing that happened was that we all deeply misread how things would break at the end. I think we all assumed that the people who hadn't committed, that the independent voters would roughly break the way those who had already declared. And it doesn't look like that happened. It looks like they almost all broke for Trump, which tells you that we missed the degree to which Hillary Clinton had failed to connect
but
in
not so,
so many different ways.
I'm not so interested in us. I'm interested in them, those who broke that way. How do you read that?
Oh, I read that more as an anti-establishment vote than to some degree a Donald Trump vote. A lot of those people said they don't believe in everything Donald Trump has said. They're willing to turn their ears off to some of the things that he said, but they were going to vote for him anyway because it was worse than the alternative of continuing. It was basically a Hail Mary pass. And, you know, sometimes that works, and it's going to take the next year or two to find out whether they think in the end that was worth the risk or whether they think that they took too big a risk, too big a leap in doing so. But I thought it was fascinating that we didn't understand the depth to which people were willing to risk an existing system at a time of significant overall prosperity, even if the recovery has left so many behind.
Risk an existing system. Jack, what's your bottom line on the election, the presidential politics of 2016? What have we seen about ourselves, and where does it point us now?
Well, I think the words of the year, according to the online dictionaries, tell us a lot. Xenophobia, paranoid, post-truth, and Merriam-Webster's number one word of the year, fascism. I mean, that points to what was, I think, unique, historically unique, about this campaign, election campaign. Donald Trump ran the most demagogic campaign in my memory, probably in American history. That is, if demagogues be defined as people who just lie and manipulate the truth, according to some scoreboards, seven out of 10 of his statements were falsehoods, a.k.a. Persisted in falsehoods or lies. He attacked basic props of the democratic system, said he wouldn't go along with the, you know, doubts about the election results. I'm reserving my opinion whether I will concede or not. He talked about jailing his opponent. He violated the norms of political discourse, which have kept a certain cap of dignity on politics. All of that was thrown out. And the result is that, you know, he ran a campaign that won. And what do we we have. You know, David says we have shaken up the system. That's one reading. The Financial Times says this is a moment for America of national decline, even decadence.
We will see. A whole lot of voters, well, more for Hillary, but the ones that mattered said, we're going with Donald Trump. We want to change here. We're going to get it. We'll see where it takes us. Cameron Templey, please stand by with The Washington Post. David Sanger with The New York Times. Jack Beatty, we are looking at a week in the news, a year in the news. Presidential politics, Trump, Brexit, Aleppo, China tensions, Russia tensions. You can join us. What do you think? What do you see as the most important developments, events of this year? Is this the year China began to really flex its muscle? Do you fear a trade war coming? And where do we end this year on Black Lives Matter and police shootings? This is On Point. David Bowie passed this year. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this year, victims of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando were remembered in a somber vigil in June. 49 died in the attack.
Stanley Almodóvar III. Amanda Alvear. Oscar A. Aracena Montero.
What a night of horror that was. After 108 years, the Chicago Cubs took the World Series. Here was the winning play.
Here's the 0-1. This is going to be a tough play. Bryant, the Cubs win the World Series! Bryant makes the play! It's over! And the Cubs have finally won it all! 8-7-10!
Only a century plus, and many passed this year. Big names, Debbie Reynolds died Wednesday. Debbie Reynolds at 84, one day after news of her daughter Carrie Fisher's death. She starred in the 1952 classic Singin' in the Rain, singing Good Morning.
Could be grander than to be in Louisiana.
We are looking at a year in the news, 2016, with David Sanger of The New York Times, Karen Tumbley of The Washington Post, and our own Jack Beatty, looking at presidential politics, Trump, Brexit, Aleppo, China tensions, Russia tensions, a sense of events tumbling in some ways, unpredictable, and not under American, as this year ends, control. Let's go to Shingle House, Pennsylvania. Amy's calling. Hi, Amy. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. This year started out absolutely horribly with my father's death on January 20th. So this January 20th, I will be eschewing all presidential inauguration events, which I normally participate in actively as a history and civics teacher, but I can't this year because I think it's just awful. And I have no idea what's going to actually happen in the 4 years hence. I don't know what's going to happen with the world, and it terrifies me.
Amy, I'm sorry about your dad. I want to pick up this theme. I mean, Karen, the sense of all bets off. Donald Trump, he uses this as a negotiating strategy in a way, but I don't think Amy is alone. Some may welcome it. Some are very fearful of it. In Washington, do you have this feeling of, wow, anything could happen here?
You know, I was not in Washington in the aftermath of the 1980 election, but people who were here said that there was, you know, some of this, not entirely comparable, but
I mean Ronald Reagan coming to town.
Exactly. There's some of this sort of sense of nobody knew where all this was taking us. Mm-hmm. And so in Washington, I think the inauguration itself is likely to be the scene of a lot of very big protests, a lot of security concerns. What I think in some ways it's going to be a moment where people are going to sort of just get out their frustrations. But the question is what happens after that and what happens on the Hill and whether there any kind of order can be brought to this system. And a lot of the people that Donald
Which
Trump
system? What do you mean order? But I mean, we've had a system that's fairly orderly for a long time.
Washington, though, has become essentially ungovernable. And so the question is whether – and that, I think, is why a lot of people were willing to take a risk on just completely blowing the place up.
Yep.
So the question now, I think, is whether Trump and a lot of his cabinet officials – you look at Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, will be the first Secretary of State in modern history to have absolutely no experience in government. He's bringing in a lot of people from – very, very different backgrounds who, you know, if anything, I mean, they don't care about how the system has been run and in fact, have something of a contempt to it. And so, you know, we'll just see how it works.
David, how much do you see as it potentially in play here? How radical a remake, if that's the right word?
Well, that is the big mystery of the next year. I mean, there is one theory under which once you're in and you're governed, you get dragged to the center by world events, by the need to protect American interests, that parties can change, but fundamental American interests don't. But I think Karen got at sort of the core when you look at some of the new appointees, an ambassador to Israel who has rejected a two-state solution.
American policy.
An American policy, not only an American policy from the Obama administration, but from the two Bush administrations that preceded
decades.
And the Clinton administration. Yeah. So, right, and decades and back to the Reagan era. You have a Secretary of State coming in who not only doesn't have experience in government, in governance, but has a lot of experience dealing with world leaders, largely to get them to extract oil from underneath their feet. And the question is, can he turn the switch in his head toward American interests that may run counter to our financial interests that he's grown up with for the past 41 years at ExxonMobil and Exxon before that? And that's a question of can you take up questions of human rights or arms control or so forth when your focus about how to deal with the world has been largely about extracting fossil fuels. We don't know. And finally, the biggest mystery is Mr. Trump himself, who on the one hand has been saying, let's pull back from the likes of Syria, let's not get into Cold War disputes and so forth. And yet, on the other hand, has came out the other day and said, if we need to have an arms race, we'll have an arms race.
A nuclear arms race. Chest-bumping with China in a way
that's
that
right.
I've never seen.
That's right. That's right.
Kyle in Dubuque, Iowa. Kyle, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it's hilarious that they can go ahead and make comments about white, uneducated rural America. I find it very insulting. They couldn't do anything.
Who's they, Kyle? Who are you talking about, they?
The Hillary campaign.
Okay, okay.
And we're flat out tired of illegal immigration, not enforcing our laws, welfare recipients, not paying taxes. We're going further in debt. We've got the worst foreign policy. They've never seen the world so unstable as it is now. They insult Trump and all their voters about being racist and how unintelligent they are, how crazy they are and everything else, and how good their candidate is. Well, my question is, I find it hilarious. If our candidate was so horrible, how in the world did she lose? If she is so good, how did she still lose? They're pointing fingers at
me. You're talking about Hillary Clinton. I mean, okay, she won the popular vote. She lost the election. Absolutely. But do you see a more you say our foreign policy has left the world unstable. Do you see a more stable era coming under President Trump, Kyle?
I really hope he stabilized the world through strength, through realizing that the United States of America is a world power, and we will stand up for our allies and not be a pushover like Obama.
Yeah, but he's saying he told Europe we won't necessarily stand up for you. He's brought alliances into question, not the opposite, Kyle. I mean, we all saw that, right?
I don't see it being any worse than what it currently is.
Yeah.
We've destabilized this world something terrible. My wife and I'd like to go travel places.
Yeah.
you know, like, and you just don't feel safe going anywhere anymore. There's violence everywhere. It's never been this bad. I think he is, regardless of race, I have nothing against him on race. The fact is, he's a poor leader. Hillary Clinton.
Who's he? You're talking about Barack Obama? Mm-hmm.
Yes, I am. Uh-huh. I think he's a poor leader. I think he's caused race division in this country, something horrible.
Kyle, we've got it. The whole bill of particulars there. I don't know that the world is necessarily more dangerous than it's ever been, but I know it can look that way, it can feel that way. I know Donald Trump described our country that way, described our country that way. I mean, Jack, you know, there's a voice right out of Iowa that looks out at the big world and says, it looks like a mess, and I want something different. I want a strong America to get it back on keel and let me feel empowered to travel the world with my wife as I will.
Make America great again. George Will today says, yes, make America great again. Return it to what it was in 1953. That's really the Trump position.
Well, but be a little more sympathetic. I mean,
I am sympathetic. I mean, there was an article in Tuesday's Times called "Bigotry Didn't Elect Trump" that really pointed to some very interesting trade data. That areas where Trump really won was in areas where Chinese imports hurt most. From, as the author said, Mason City, Iowa, to Hickory, North Carolina. And if, according to the study, if the import competition from China had been half as large, Mrs. Clinton would have won the election, would have won those areas. And, of course, the China trade deal, all that, went through under Bill Clinton. You know, when Donald Trump said, you are the forgotten people and I am your voice, they were forgotten. They were forgotten by the Democratic Party.
David, I mean, you hear our caller from Iowa who wants stability and he wants American power asserted. At the same time, for example, in the stuff with China, and I mean, can we have war here? What is on the table? There's a kind of blowing past diplomatic niceties. I don't care about diplomatic niceties, but I don't want war.
Well, first, Tom, I'm not sure that his assessment of just how horrible the world is compared to times past actually holds up to much of a test. Yes, there are a lot of small wars underway.
Yeah.
Yes, we have terrorism. And yes, we hear about it instantly all mm-hmm. thanks to modern communications. Compared to the 20th century where we went through two great wars and lost tens of millions of people on a scale that we have not seen in recent years. No, I would not say that this what we're going through now is the end of the world. It's not even close.
But are we looking at some kind of reckoning here? China's power is coming up. It's feeling right. muscular, obviously, and Donald Trump's gone right in its face.
That's absolutely right. And so then the question is, how do you manage a world in which we are no longer going to be, just by dint of size of economy and population and our willingness to intercede in the world, necessarily the only big player? And one constant between Barack Obama and Donald Trump has been the argument that we needn't be the central player in every single thing.
But Obama talked that talk. Trump is not talking that talk. He's talking big power talk, even if he wants a modest foreign policy.
He has talked both because when I sat down to do two interviews with him with Maggie Haberman, he kept discussing the areas of the world, starting with the Middle East, where he saw no value for the United States to get deeply involved. Now, does this seem to contradict his, you know, we want to go back to the 50s and be the fulsome power? Yes, it does. But what's happened in the interim? China has risen from a tiny power to the world's second largest economy. We have other rising powers. And so we're going to have to figure out a way to accommodate a world that is not static. You're not getting 1955 back.
But Karen, you heard our Amy calling from Pennsylvania, said she feels full of apprehension that things could just really blow up here. Can you comfort her?
Well, I don't know because I don't know. The fact is that on maybe if you look at this historic context, the world is not a worse place than it's been. But it does feel in many ways, thanks to technology, thanks to the speed with which information travels and the way that it travels, that, you know, things could blow up with sort of no warning and come out of nowhere. And I think that, as much as anything, is what has people so much on edge. It's not the numbers, it's not the statistics, it's the fact that, you know, when things happen, even relatively small things in the grand scheme of history, everybody feels it in a way that I think they didn't.
I mean, maybe it's just that, but Mr. Trump is also sort of ratcheting up the sense of anything can happen here. Maybe it's negotiating. Maybe it'll work great for him. One more call. Eric in Detroit. Eric, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. One of the things I have to say was when I look at this year is, as an African-American,
yeah,
I look at people who voted for Trump differently. And I actually have renewed respect for, you know, white colleagues or neighbors or friends who are able to see what it was Trump was doing. But it's changed how I look at a lot of people.
What are you, you look at them with happiness or with something else? What?
In my mind, if you voted for Trump, you're racist, period. I don't shop at places where the owner has a Trump sign, period. And there's no going back from that. I'm not forgetting it, and I'm still angry.
Eric, that's as plain as can be, and I appreciate your call. I mean, Jack, here we are. It's going to be 2017 in a couple of days, and we're going to have a new kind of president, a billionaire who plays by different rules. What's your sense of the year to come, of the administration to come, Jack?
It just feels all so perilous, Tom. Mr. Trump's character does not inspire confidence. He's impulsive. He acts on the basis often of misinformation or even conspiracy theories. The people around him are similarly inclined. It's very hard to see how he stays in touch with realities that are forever changing. And then there's the matter of sort of the aperture that he of attention he can give. I've read that he has about a 5-minute attention span. The world doesn't allow for that. And so, quite apart from his views, just his character and his temperament make this a very worrying time.
David, can you see a way that goes another way, that Donald Trump, in fact, brings American strength back?
Well, I think he could certainly bring back the perception of American strength. The question is, in a first year of a presidency, new presidents always get challenged. They get challenged by other powers. They get challenged by domestic politics. And the question is, how prepared is he for that? And that's going to be the mystery of this new year. And all we can do is wish that it all works out well.
Hang on to our hats. We are headed straight into it. We're so grateful to all three of you for being with us on this day. David Sanger, National Security Correspondent for the New York Times. Happy New Year, and thank you so much for being with us, David.
Thanks, Tom, and Happy New Year to you.
Karen Tumulty, National Political Correspondent for the Washington Post. Same greetings to you, Karen. Thank you so much for being here today.
Have a great 2017.
You too, Karen. And Jack, wonderful 2017 to you, sir. Let's hope for the best.
And to you and all our listeners.
We'll go out with George Michael, dead this year at 53. Takes us back to the 1980s. Thanks for joining us. 2017, here we come. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I don't want to miss it when you hit that high. Wake me.